We are live lavish.
Leave a fight, we get but still love over them.
We laugh,
fuck up over them. Last the book of them. The more them try to fight, we turn up and up again.
We money enough and up again. Get big and suck again. Get the powder and the hand out, no you use to work again.
Can't tell us to broke again. Them girl, we still a fuck again. The money and the fame, you know we have it over them.
Left on a beat a Rolex. Rose gold, me neck a wear. If I not John, then we in a alligator wear. Fussy and look a stripe, better you get a beer. We lucky this is take the key and we don't left a spear.
Career. Accessories, decor, and much more. They will also be selling a delicious, hearty, homemade lunch for $5. The food bank distributes food and serves hot meals to neighbors in need. The Milton Park Bazaar will be held at 3594 Jean Mals in the basement of St. John's Lutheran Church from 12 to 3 p.m. on Saturday, April 6th. That's this Saturday on the corner of Jean Mals and Prince Arthur. Hope to see you there. Help us bring food to the table. For more info, contact mpfoodbank@gmail.com.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I feel like my children will die in front of my eyes. What can I say? I don't know what I am to do. I can feel them dying before my eyes. This is my daughter. It's been 5 days she is without food or drink.
USAID officials have privately warned President Biden famine in Gaza is unprecedented in modern history. As the official death toll in Gaza tops 33,000, we speak to a prominent Israeli professor about how Israel put Gaza on the road to famine. Plus, we talk to a Palestinian-American doctor who volunteered in Gaza about why he walked out of a White House meeting with President Biden.
You cannot engage and try to get us to come out and show up in the primaries or in November, at the same time approving billions of dollars of 2,000-pound bombs that I personally saw devastate Khan Yunis and Deir Belah and all the areas in Gaza. That sort of cognitive dissonance is not something that it just our community glosses over.
Then from prison to the presidency. We go to Senegal, where a pair of opposition leaders went from prison to ruling Senegal in 3 weeks.
Le Sénégal sous mon magistère.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope, a country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy.
We get an update from Dakar. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The founder of World Central Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres, has accused Israel of systematically targeting the 7 aid workers who were killed Monday in a series of drone strikes in Gaza. Chef Andres spoke to Reuters Wednesday.
The end is what we know, what everybody knows, that 17 members between the specialty security people we have, three British individuals and three international crew plus one Palestinian, that they were targeted systematically, car by car.
The killing of the aid workers has sparked global outrage. World Central Kitchen and other aid groups have halted aid deliveries at a time when northern Gaza is facing famine. The United Nations has temporarily halted all operations at night in Gaza for at least 48 hours to reassess security protocols. According to the United Nations, 196 aid workers have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. President Biden scheduled to speak with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today as the official death toll in Gaza tops 33,000. Biden has said he was outraged by the attack on the aid workers, but the U.S. is continuing to arm Israel. Palestinians say the attack on the aid workers is part of a broader campaign to starve the people of Gaza.
They bombed the World Central Kitchen to starve the Palestinian people, so that the Palestinian people do not survive in their land and homeland. We call on all Arab peoples to stand with us and witness what has happened to the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people are humiliated. Their dignity was stripped away. We no longer have homes or anything. The Palestinian people have been living in humiliation from the 1948 war until now.
The Israeli publication 972 has exposed how the Israeli military has used an artificial intelligence program known as Lavender to develop a kill list in Gaza that includes as many as 37,000 Palestinians who were targeted for assassination with little human oversight. A second AI system known as Where's Daddy tracked Palestinian men on the kill list. It was purposely designed to help Israel target individuals when they were at home at night with their families. The World Health Organization's warning many patients could soon die if they're not evacuated from Al-Shifa Hospital, which has been left in ruins after a two-week Israeli military siege. Medical crews have found hundreds of bodies scattered across the medical complex. Palestinians are still searching the grounds for loved ones.
I am now searching for six people we lost in the war. My sister, all of her children, and my niece Alma. May Allah have mercy on her. I have found no trace of them. They were buried here. We don't know what happened to their bodies or where they went. We don't know anything. Here we find a number of uncovered bodies, and they are unidentified. We don't know what to do with them.
Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz has called for early elections to be held in September. Gantz is the top political rival to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who continues to face daily protests in Israel. In Britain, pressure is growing on Prime Minister Rishi Sunak to suspend arms sales to Israel. Three former British Supreme Court justices have joined hundreds of lawyers, legal academics, and retired judges to warn that continued arms sales could make Britain complicit in genocide. This is David Lammy, foreign policy chief of the opposition Labour Party.
All of the British public can see the scenes coming out of Gaza, children lying in rubble, deep concerns being made about international human rights law. And for all of those reasons, that advice should be published. And if it is the case that international law has been contravened, then it's absolutely right that offensive arms are suspended to Israel.
Meanwhile, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez says his country will recognize Palestinian statehood by July. This comes as Palestine's UN representatives have renewed a push for full membership at the international body. Here in New York, tallies from Tuesday's primary election show around 12% of Democratic voters in New York State cast a blank ballot instead of voting for President Biden. In Ukraine, Russian drones hit multiple apartment buildings in Kharkiv early this morning, killing at least four people, including rescue workers. This is a 77-year-old survivor of the attack.
It is dark there, impossible to see. All the windows are broken, everything blown out, nothing is left. It's good that we're alive, thank God.
NATO members met Wednesday to discuss long-term military funding for Ukraine. NATO's weighing a possible $100 billion five-year fund in what's seen as a Trump-proof way of ensuring continued support to Kyiv, even if he's elected president. In related news, Ukraine is lowering its conscription age from 27 to 25 as the war grinds on for a third year following Russia's invasion. In Russia, a court sentenced in absentia Russian-Canadian artist and Pussy Riot activist Pyotr Vervizov to 8 years in prison for social media posts condemning the invasion of Ukraine. Vervizov announced last year he joined the Ukrainian army fighting against Russian forces, though his current whereabouts are uncertain. Turkey's top election authority says it's reinstating the victory of Abdullah Zeydan of the pro-Kurdish People's Equality and Democracy Party after his removal led to protests and a crackdown by police. Zeydan won over 55% of the vote in the eastern city of Van in Sunday's elections, but the city's election board denied him victory, saying he was disqualified due to a previous conviction. The local election board had said the mayorship should instead go to the candidate of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's AK Party, who won just 27% of the vote. Abdullah Zeydan's reinstatement is the latest blow to President Erdogan after the opposition Republican People's Party won mayoral races in Turkey's five largest cities Sunday. In Kenya, public hospital doctors are in their third week of a nationwide strike over pay issues. The doctors' union has taken their protest to the streets as it demands the Kenyan government pay them for past wages they're still owed and hire over 3,000 unemployed medical interns.
Medical services are not free. You cannot tell us that medicine is a calling. Apart from being a calling, medicine is a career. It is a career. We are human beings. We need to be paid. We are human beings.
The ongoing strike has led to major disruptions in healthcare across Kenya, but the government says they don't have the funds to fulfill strikers' demands as it navigates a looming debt crisis. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has declared a national disaster over the protracted drought plaguing the region, warning some 2.7 million people will face hunger this year. Zambia and Malawi have also declared states of disaster related to the drought, which has triggered a massive grain shortage. In the Philippines, hundreds of schools were forced to close this week due to extreme heat and an elevated risk of heat stroke. The heat index hit over 111 degrees Fahrenheit in some areas. Scientists have confirmed this March was the hottest ever recorded. It was also the 10th consecutive month to set a global heat record. New York Judge Juan Merchan has denied Donald Trump's latest attempt to use a presidential immunity defense, this time in his criminal hush money case. Merchan also rejected Trump's bid to delay the trial's April 15th start. The last two survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre appeared at Oklahoma Supreme Court this week in a bid to revive their reparations lawsuit. An estimated 300 black people were killed when a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood, Oklahoma. Viola Fletcher and Leslie Benningfield Randall are now both 109 years old. In a statement, the two women said, quote, "We're grateful that our now weary bodies have held on long enough to witness an America and an Oklahoma that provides race massacre survivors with the opportunity to access the legal system. The Oklahoma Supreme Court has the power to open the doors of justice," they said. And 56 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. His family members are holding their annual wreath-laying ceremony in Atlanta. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. President Biden is scheduled to speak with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today for the first time since Israeli forces sparked international outrage by killing seven aid workers from World Central Kitchen. The organization's founder, Chef Jose Andres, has accused Israel of systematically targeting the aid workers who went to Gaza with a shipload of aid to feed starving Palestinians. While Biden has said he was outraged by the killings, the White House has indicated it plans to keep arming Israel, even as the death toll in Gaza tops 33,000. The Biden administration is preparing to approve a new $18 billion arms deal for Israel that includes as many as 50 American-made F-15 fighter jets. The U.S. also recently approved sending 1,800 2,000-pound bombs, which can be used to level entire city blocks, as well as 500 more 500-pound bombs.
Earlier this week, the White House was forced to cancel its planned Ramadan dinner after many Muslim American leaders refused to go to protest Biden's Gaza policy. Instead of a dinner, Biden held a scaled-back meeting Tuesday with Muslim American community figures, but that, too, was met with protests. The Palestinian-American emergency room physician, Thayer Ahmed, walked out of the White House meeting. Before leaving, he gave President Biden a letter from an 8-year-old orphaned Palestinian girl named Hadil that read, "I beg you, President Biden, stop them from entering Rafah." Dr. Thayer Ahmed is a board member for Med Global, which has an office in Gaza and is working with the World Health Organization. He recently volunteered at Al Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in Gaza. Dr. Thayer Ahmed joins us now from Chicago. Dr. Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us. Can you describe that meeting? I mean, it was hours after we learned of the killing of the 7 aid workers in Gaza. Talk about how the meeting, the dinner was canceled, who was at the meeting, and what you did there in meeting President Biden.
You know, this meeting, we first started to hear about it a week prior to its schedule, and it was pitched as a working dinner. It was in lieu of the annual Ramadan iftar that the White House does. But this, given the circumstances and the famine that was in Gaza, they wanted to do a working dinner with the president. Well, the few members of the Muslim American community really pushed back on that. And they said it didn't feel appropriate to be eating and talking about a famine. It actually came off as quite distasteful. And it was changed to a working meeting with the president, where it would just be direct, intimate conversation with the president of the United States, the vice president, and other members of his administration. And I was the only Palestinian-American doctor there, but there was also going to be other medical professionals. And we were told that we were going to be the first people to brief the president about the situation on the ground who had actually been in Gaza after October 7th. And so, you know, leading up to this meeting, we thought this might be an opportunity to really relay the message, even though it was quite surprising to hear that the president had not really spoken with anybody who had been working on the ground directly. His other staff members have, but President Biden himself had not heard from people who had been on the ground. But as you had mentioned in the lead up here, there were so many different incidents that took place over the past week that really, you know, suggested that this meeting was not going to be impactful. And in fact, it may have been better to just not attend this meeting. And I think the World Central Kitchen thing was the final event when you saw 7 aid workers get assassinated. I just want to remind people, these were 3 separate missiles, 3 different vehicles as a part of the World Central Kitchen convoy, and they were hit multiple times. I mean, when Jose Andres says this is targeted, he's justified in suggesting that. And it's also important to know that despite the famine that's in the north, World Central Kitchen was one of the few organizations that was consistently coordinating with the Israeli military to be able to access the north. And so this came on the heels of the weapons deals, of the bombs that are being transferred. And so even if there's a change in the rhetoric with the Biden administration, the actions of that week really upset all of the people who were attending. And when we finally sat in the meeting and the president began with his remarks just saying, "We want to hear from you guys. This is a listening session," I ultimately had to excuse myself after telling him that, you know, Rafah needs to be a red line. Under no circumstance can there be an Israeli invasion into Rafah, given everything that we've heard about how the Israelis operate. And anybody that's trying to convince the president or his staff or the administration that it can be done in a safe manner is not telling you the truth. It cannot be done. You cannot evacuate Palestinians out of Rafah and treat them like sheep, assuming they can be herded around anywhere, and assume everything is going to go fine. I said, make no mistake about it, it's going to be a bloodbath. And then I got up and handed him that letter from Hadil the orphan and excused myself and walked out of the meeting.
And what did Biden say?
He just looked at the letter and he said he understood, because I let him know that, you know, the community that I hail from, the Palestinian diaspora, it's reeling. We're grieving. We feel like for 6 months we've been totally ignored. And with all of the decisions that were made over the past couple of weeks alone, it suggested that we still were not going to have a voice, that we still were not going to have a seat at the table and be able to share our concerns and for those concerns to be met, you know, with serious deliberation and to be acknowledged at the very minimum. And, you know, the UN Security Council passed a ceasefire resolution that the U.S. abstained from. Why then do we hear at the very next moment, the State Department undermining that resolution and saying, oh, it's non-binding. Why are we hearing about, you know, all of the fighter jets? And somebody may say, oh, you know, this $18 billion worth of fighter jets and ammunition, it's years away. But it's literally, it's what it means. It suggests that the United States is going to continue Israel with military aid. And it suggests also that they're comfortable with how they're prosecuting the war. And, you know, for every single person that's interested in this, Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, progressive, human rights defender, humanitarian, everybody is totally against how this war has been prosecuted and the incredible amount of suffering that has taken place. You know, famine in the north, invasion in the south, and infrastructure devastated everywhere. You know, I was in Nasser Hospital. Nasser is just one of the many different hospitals that has been systematically targeted. If we lose all of the hospital infrastructure and healthcare system and healthcare workers, if this invasion happens in Rafah, where are they supposed to go? Where are they supposed to get treatment if they're somehow casualties? You know, Netanyahu suggested that in war, after the World Central Kitchen convoy was attacked, initially he said war, sometimes, you know, this is what happens. It's unfortunate or tragic. Well, what about the 1.7 million Palestinians in Rafah? If they're just mistakenly hit, is that just tragic because they're going to die in the street because the healthcare system can't afford to treat them? And so these were some of the concerns that we had when we were approaching this meeting. And it's the concern of the entire international NGO community.
Well, I want to turn, Dr. Ahmad, to Wednesday's press briefing at the White House, where Biden's press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, took questions about Tuesday's meeting.
Was last night the president's first opportunity to speak face-to-face with someone who had been on the ground providing aid in Gaza?
So, look, I can't speak to the different leaders who have been in this meeting. It is a private meeting.
If I can also go back to something that was asked earlier about the president meeting with any aid workers or anybody who's been inside of Gaza since October 7th. It is a question I've also privately posed to some of your colleagues, and it feels like a yes or no question whether or not he's actually met with somebody who's been inside. And the reason I'm asking is a number of people at the meeting said, to their knowledge, this was the first time the president had actually spoken to anybody who's been inside of Gaza since October 7th.
Well, here's what I can tell you. He's met with community leaders who are obviously from the Muslim community, the Arab community, the Palestinian community. I would let them speak for themselves on if they've been to Gaza.
So, Dr. Ahmad, your response to what Jean-Pierre said?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that she doesn't want to answer the question because it was the first time that the president would be in front of somebody. And, you know, it may be that the president is well briefed on the situation, has all of the numbers, has all the facts and figures. And I'm sure that they're, you know, aware of what's happening with respect to the Gaza Strip. But the level of detail that you can get with people who have been on the ground, I think, is vital information. And I also know that we're talking about Israeli counterparts who are probably briefing the entire administration far more regularly than anybody from the Palestinian community, from the Muslim community, from aid organizations that are on the ground. And it's important for the president to hear some of the concerns of people who are on the ground, who are actually interacted with the people that are suffering, who are in different hospitals. A lot of this is important because so much of the rhetoric surrounding some of the healthcare system attacks or the aid convoy attacks or kind of what is taking place in the streets of Palestine and Gaza, so much of that rhetoric is dominated only by the Israelis. You don't hear about what's going on from the Palestinian perspective on the ground. They're not able to share with you that 10,000 families were sheltering in Nasser Hospital prior to being raided. They can't tell you that at Shifa Hospital Complex, after it was raided and shut down in November, that it was slowly coming up to speed and that people who were sheltering had returned there, the emergency department started to see patients again. You don't get to hear that aspect of it. And I think that's truly, you know, tragic, considering it's been 6 months of this conflict, and this would be the first time that the president had been able to do that. The other thing I want to mention, too, is, you know, with respect to the World Central Kitchen, the president did say that he was outraged about this. I know he's going to have a phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu with respect to this. But it'd be important also if the president got to hear from other aid organizations that had also been hit. You know, Medical Aid for Palestine back in January, they have a compound with International Rescue Committee that was hit. Thankfully, nobody died, but it's important important to figure out, why did the Israeli military strike that compound with a missile? Doctors Without Borders, they've had two people being killed in an airstrike as well. It's important to hear from them. Why did that happen? You know, this is a systematic thing that's taken place with respect to targeting aid convoys, healthcare workers, healthcare institutions, civilian infrastructure. And so for people who actually were on the ground directly affected by this, I think it's important for the president to hear about this. And so, you know, the other thing is there's something that I think the Biden administration should hear loud and clear. It's people want to be able to contribute and engage and share their opinions. They want a voice. They want a seat at the table. But it's got to be meaningful. It's got to be impactful. People have been talking for 6 months about what's important to happen in the Gaza Strip, and that's a ceasefire, and that's getting aid in. And there's been no concrete steps towards that. In fact, it's been the opposite. It's only been a blank check given to the Israelis and just diplomatic cover with every single horrific thing that emerges out of the Gaza Strip. And I think that's why people are hesitant to the meeting. That's why people want to engage with the president and the vice president, but are not going to do so until they see something changes with respect to policy and action.
Dr. Ahmad, also to say what you mentioned, that there have been as many as 190 aid workers killed before this week's attack and death of seven World Central Kitchen aid workers. But I want to go now to National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby being questioned Tuesday.
Is firing a missile at people delivering food and killing them not a violation of international humanitarian law?
Well, Israelis have already admitted that this was a mistake that they made. They're doing an investigation. They'll get to the bottom of this. Let's not get ahead of that.
The State Department has a process in place. And to date, as you and I are speaking, they have not found any incidents where the Israelis have violated international humanitarian law.
So, Dr. Ahmad, that Israel has not violated international humanitarian law, your response?
Yeah, I mean, I would say if you were to ask John Kirby if any civilian or innocent person has died in this war, I guarantee you he'd probably give you a very vague answer and say we've not found anything to suggest that in any of our investigations. I mean, it's totally ridiculous and outrageous for that to be the response, especially this is in the setting of the World Central Kitchen tragedy of seven people being killed. This is the sort of response that you get. And I think for me, that's part of the problem here is the messaging that we're hearing, especially from somebody like John Kirby. It's something that is totally unacceptable. We are hearing about violation after violation. I'm not a lawyer, but it's kind of strange to hear that the entire community of people who have been looking at international humanitarian law, all of the experts, the eyewitnesses, are suggesting that there is some serious violations taking place here. And it's happening multiple times over the course of 6 months, that in fact, it starts to suggest that there's a pattern of behavior in place here. And then instead, you get a response saying, be patient, watch out, we've got to look into investigation. Everything we've seen so far has suggested that there isn't any there. I mean, there's 33,000 dead Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. How did that happen? I mean, John Kirby wouldn't be able to answer that question based on the tone that he's taken. And I think that's, again, highlighting what we're talking about when we say it seems like this sort of support, this diplomatic cover for the Biden administration is unwavering. Even though the rhetoric or tone may change here and there with respect to acknowledging the human suffering that's taking place in the humanitarian catastrophe, all of these other comments sort of support the broader theme of what's taking place in Gaza over the last 6 months. And it's that the United States is fully supporting what the Israeli military is doing. And so, you know, what I would say is when President Biden has that call with Prime Minister Netanyahu, I would say that it's important for him to draw a red line, for him to make a demand and to suggest that there are consequences if things don't change with respect to what's happening in the Gaza Strip.
Doctor, I wanted to go to the founder of the World Central Kitchen, the world-renowned chef, Jose Andres, who accused Israel of systematically targeting the seven aid workers who were killed Monday night in that series of drone strikes in Gaza. Chef Andres spoke to Reuters Wednesday.
The end is what we know, what everybody knows, that seven team members between the specialty security people we have, three British individuals and three international crew plus one Palestinian, that they were target systematically, car by car. They attacked the first car. We're still trying to get all the information on what happened on the first car. We have a feeling they were able to escape safely because it was an armored vehicle. This was only the third day we had armored vehicles. Within 6 months trying to bring them in. But the first armored vehicle was hit. They were able to escape. We still don't know all the details on the events in terms of people injured or people even dead. They were able to move in the second one. Again, this one was hit. They were able to move in the third one. In the process, we know they were trying to call. But in the chaos of the moment, whatever happened, to try to be telling IDF that what are they doing, that they were targeting us in at the conflicting zone, in an area controlled by IDF, them knowing that was our teams moving on that route with two armor, with three cars. And then they hit the third one, and then we saw the consequences of that continuous targeting attack. Seven people dead, but there are seven on top of a list of more than another 190 humanitarian workers that they've been killed over the last 6 months.
Israel and the United States have said that the attacks were not deliberate. Do you accept that?
Well, totally. Initially, I would say categorically no. Even if we were not in coordination with the IDF, not democratic country and not military can be targeting civilians and humanitarians, especially when the technology today allows you to know things in ways not too long ago was not possible. Those drones have eyes on everything that moves in Gaza. I've been there. This is drones nonstop flying above you. It's nothing that moves that IDF doesn't know.
Clearly, Dr. Ahmed, the establishment consensus has now broken. I've seen Democratic senator after senator starting to question U.S. military aid to Israel. President Biden knows Chef Jose Andres. Now, the seven people who were killed, the three British nationals, the Polish national, the Canadian-American national, we have not heard the Canadian prime minister or the president name that person, the Australian. These are six international aid workers plus a Palestinian aid worker. Clearly, that's what's changing that conversation, because, as you pointed out, almost 200 aid workers have been killed in the last months. You're planning to go back to Gaza. You are Palestinian-American. Are you concerned you, too, like so many of your colleagues, could be targeted as a doctor, as a nurse, as a medical aid worker in Gaza?
I mean, of course, that's always primary concern. I think it's because we have the same realization that most other agencies and organizations and relief workers have, and that's there's no place that's safe in the Gaza Strip. Again, World Central Kitchen, when Jose Andres is saying that route was deconflicted, he's saying that the coordinates and the movement were shared in real time with the Israeli military. And this is an organization that has an excellent relationship with the IDF. And the fact that their convoy was hit three separate times, despite them trying to reach out, nobody's safe. I mean, you know, there's about 200 aid workers that have been killed, but also 400 healthcare workers. You know, this is journalists, over 100 journalists have been killed in this process. There is nobody that's safe. And I think one comment that I want to make that Chef Jose had really mentioned is anything that moves. And that's such an important thing for people to recognize in the Gaza Strip, that there are areas where there is total control by the Israeli military. And if there's any sort of movement, those people come under fire and are killed. And there is a footage just from last week of two Palestinians on the beach waving the white flag. We can clearly see that they're unarmed, and them being killed and then buried with a bulldozer on the beach in Gaza. I mean, that's the kind of landscape that you're talking about. This is, there's so many different areas in the Gaza Strip where you cannot walk around, does not matter, man, woman, or child, and you are under the threat of attack. And so it's everybody. It's all parts of society, aid workers, healthcare workers. So it's important for people to recognize and understand the counter narrative here to anything that would suggest that there are armed people or militants that are being targeted. Every single person in the Gaza Strip is not safe. And if they're moving at the wrong place at the wrong time, they will be killed. There's no other conclusion or outcome of that scenario.
Dr. Thayer Ahmed, we want to thank you for being with us, emergency room physician who spent 3 weeks in Gaza volunteering at Al-Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, board member for MedGlobal, which has an office in Gaza, is working with the World Health Organization. He walked out of a White House meeting with President Biden this week. Next up, we speak with a prominent Israeli professor about how Israel put Gaza on the road to famine. Back in 20 seconds.
I got your letter today, and I miss you all so much here. I can't wait to see you all, and I'm counting the days here. I still believe that there's gold at the end of the world, and I'll come home to Illinois on the day.
Day After Tomorrow by Phoebe Bridgers, an artist for Ceasefire. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
A group of U.S. officials at USAID have privately warned the Biden administration that the spread of hunger and malnutrition in Gaza is, quote, unprecedented in modern history, and that parts of Gaza are already experiencing famine. This comes as several aid groups are suspending work in Gaza after Israel killed 7 aid workers with World Central Kitchen earlier this week. In a moment, we'll speak to prominent law Israeli professor Liev Gordon about the famine in Gaza, but we begin with the words of two Palestinian mothers. This is Khulud Al-Masri speaking at the Al-Awda Health Center in Rafah, where her children are being treated.
I feel like my children will die in front of my eyes. What can I say? I don't know what I am to do. I can feel them dying before my eyes. This is my daughter. It's been 5 days she is without food or drink. I don't know what to do for her. I am suffering, sitting with my children. I am tired with them. It's two of them, not just one. There's not food or milk available. The girl is suffering from malnutrition. She is tired. The situation is so difficult. I am tired. I swear I am very tired. Their condition is very bad. My daughter is suffering in front of me, and I don't know what to do for them. I am unable to provide them with milk or Pampers or food. I don't know what to do for them. The two of them are so unwell. This one, my daughter, has been like this for 5 or 6 days.
That was a Palestinian mother named Khulud Al-Masri. And this is another mother named Reem Al-Qadi, who spoke as she held her crying baby.
My daughter is ill, and she is suffering from malnutrition, and her blood is weak. We, of course, in the hospital are suffering from a catastrophic situation, a catastrophic health situation, very bad. There's no drinking water at all. The hospital is suffering and unable to provide water for us to give to our children. Our children have come here, not to get better and healthier, but their health situations have gotten worse. Most medications are not available. Healthy food is not available for our children. Healthy water is not available for our children. On one bed, they put 3 and 4 cases, which result in the children infecting each other and making their situations worse than before. Of course, all of this is because of the Israeli occupation, the situation which we are in. They bombed hospitals. They tell us a hospital is a safe space. The hospital now is not a safe space. Most hospitals are no longer in service. All the sick are now being treated in 1 or 2 hospitals in the whole of the Gaza Strip. This is really a difficult situation, and we ask all countries, the world, to take our side and relieve us of this situation. It's enough. Our children are dying in front of us, and we are unable to do anything for them.
That was a Palestinian mother named Reem Al-Qadi speaking at a hospital in Rafah. We go now to London, where we're joined by Niamh Gordon, Professor of International Law and Human Rights at Queen Mary University of London, Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom for British Society of Middle East Studies. He's the author of several books, including Israel's Occupation and co-author of Human Shields, A History of People and the Line of Fire. He's co-editor of Torture, Human Rights, Medical Ethics and the Case of Israel. And he just wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books. It's headlined The Road to Famine in Gaza. Professor Gordon, thanks so much for being with us. Why don't you take us on that journey? Tell us the antecedents to what we're seeing today, the issue of famine in Gaza.
So perhaps I'll begin with what we're seeing and then move back. We're seeing destruction and we're seeing massive displacement in an area that's already food insecure. And then we're seeing Israel obstructing aid from entering Gaza. So on average, in the past 6 months, 112 trucks have been entering per day, while before October 7th, 500 trucks were entering each day. We're seeing consistent attacks on aid workers, as you mentioned in the previous item, with on average one aid worker being killed every day. And we're seeing the destruction of one third of the agricultural land in the Gaza Strip, 20% of the greenhouses, and 70% of the fishing vessels in the Gaza Strip. So no internal food can be produced in the Gaza Strip. And as you mentioned earlier, what we're witnessing and what Reem and Khulod have just expressed is the most horrific situation a parent can experience is their children dying in front of them of famine. Now, what we wrote, Muna Haddad and me, is about the history of using food as a weapon in the Gaza Strip. So if in 1967 Israel occupies the Gaza Strip, its approach is very different in the beginning. It surveys the Gaza Strip. It counts the agricultural land. It looks what the Palestinians are planting. And in the beginning, what it does is it actually plants trees and provides the Palestinians with better varieties of seeds. And it monitors the food basket of the Palestinians. And in its reports, it tells us that there's the food basket in 1966 was 2,400 calories per person. And after 4 years of occupation, it's now 2,700, basically boasting about the improvement in the food basket. But what we see already then is that that Israel's controlling the Palestinian food basket. And in the beginning, it wants to kind of increase the productive energies of the Palestinians so they can work in Israel as cheap laborers and extract their labor for Israel's use. Everything begins to change in the first Palestinian Intifada in December 1987, where Israel begins imposing restrictions on the Gaza Strip, first by creating magnetic cards that monitor the entrance of laborers into Israel and restricts the entrance of laborers to Israel. It also, a few years later, creates a fence and fences the Gaza Strip so that creates only four or five crossings. And later on, with the Second Intifada, we see a total reversal of the approach after 1967. We see Israel destroying agricultural land. We see it creating a buffer zone around the fence so that Palestinians, farmers cannot get near the fence. We see it destroying fishing vessels, and we see it limiting further the Palestinian food basket. Then comes 2005, Israel unilateral withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, the movement of its soldiers to the fence, the beginning use of the drones over the Gaza skies. And after Hamas wins in democratic elections in the Gaza Strip, we see the implementation of a blockade where Israel basically blocks the Gaza Strip and monitors very carefully what enters and what exits. It further destroys more agricultural land, and then it creates the Ministry of Defense with the Ministry of Health, creates lists of items that can enter the Gaza Strip and items that cannot enter. So flour and baby formula can enter, but chocolate and certain kinds of pastas cannot enter. And Israel begins to monitor the calorie intake of the population and creates what's called a humanitarian minimum. We will allow, Israel says, a humanitarian minimum to enter the Gaza Strip, leaving the population regularly in a situation of food insecurity and controlling and managing the population through food insecurity. And every time there's a cycle of violence, and there's been five major cycles of violence since 2008 until today, Israel closes off all the borders, and what had been a food insecurity before the cycle of violence drops dramatically, and we see incidents of malnutrition and so forth. And so this is kind of the background of what we've been seeing. And when this war begins, so we see that everything you've been describing earlier is intentional, because Israel has been controlling the food basket and using it as a weapon since the beginning of the occupation until today.
And Professor Neve Gordon, you make the case in your article that, and this is perhaps one of the most surprising things, that Israel has made no attempt to conceal its policy of restricting food to Gaza. You cite Sarah Roy's earlier piece in the New York Review of Books, quoting her citation of a cable sent from the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv to the Secretary of State on November 3rd, 2008. The cable reads, "As part of their overall embargo plan against Gaza, Israeli officials have confirmed to embassy officials on multiple occasions that they intend to keep the Gazan economy on the brink of collapse without quite pushing it over the edge." So if you could elaborate on that and what you understand the justification of that to be, and why they would be so disclosive about it to the Americans.
So what we see is we see a process from Oslo, where Oslo was sold to the public as a peace process that will bring economic dividends for Israel and the Palestinians. And if you remember, at the time, Gaza was described as the new Singapore, and we will make Gaza thrive, and there will be a Singapore in the Middle East. Now, what we see in the years immediately after the Oslo Accords were signed, that indeed Israel was enjoying the economic dividends in the Gaza from the Oslo Accords, but the Palestinians, both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and particularly in Gaza, the economic situation drops because Israel is basically strangling the Palestinian economy. And if you mention Sarah Roy, then I will use her concept of de-development. Israel de-develops the Gaza Strip, destroying the agricultural land, destroying the factories, and it is not shy in doing so. It is basically asserting its control and letting the Palestinians in Gaza know who is the lord of the land, and letting the American counterparts also know who is the lord of the land. And through this, we see a situation where the economics, the major reason for the food insecurity in the Gaza Strip before this war was indeed the blockade. But the blockade, what it does, it strangles the Gaza Strip economically. So a year before the war, we have a GDP per capita in the Gaza Strip of about $1,000 per person, while in Israel, it's $52,000. An hour away, this is before the war, an hour away from my apartment in Be'er Sheva, where I used to live, and Gaza Strip, that's the distance between the two regions. Yet in the Gaza Strip, a newborn is seven times more likely to die than in Be'er Sheva because the social detriments of health, because the economic strangulation, because of the lack of health care, and so forth. And it, the message was clear from the beginning. We control you. If you do not bow down, then we will hit you harder. And that's what Israel has been doing for years in the Gaza Strip, and that's what it's been, and the Americans have been watching, Americans have been seeing this happen, and the Americans have not said anything to Israel in this sense and not stopped Israel's actions. And then we have October 7th, and we've seen what's happened since then.
Well, Professor Nev Gordon, we have to break here, but we want to ask you to stay after the show so we can continue this conversation. We'll post it online at democracynow.org. Professor Gordon teaches international law and human rights at Queen Mary University of London. We'll link to your piece in the New York Review of Books headlined "The Road to Famine in Gaza." Next up, we go to Senegal, where a pair of opposition leaders went from prison to the presidency and the prime ministership in 3 weeks. Stay with us. Ambela Mama, Mother's Prayer by Mokumba. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show in Senegal, where the newly inaugurated president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, has named Ousmane Sonko to be his prime minister, capping a remarkable three-week period that saw the two opposition figures go from prison to ruling Senegal, vowing to fight poverty, injustice and corruption. Faye and Sonko were released from prison in mid-March, just days before Faye won Senegal's election to replace President Macky Sall, who'd attempted to delay the vote. Faye was officially inaugurated Tuesday.
Le Sénégal sous mon magistère.
Under my leadership, Senegal will be a country of hope, a country at peace, with an independent justice system and a strengthened democracy. This is my promise, based on the oath I have just taken before God and the nation in your presence. I am aware that the results of the ballot box express a profound desire for systemic change. Through my election, the Senegalese people have committed themselves to building a fair Senegal, a prosperous Senegal, a progressing Africa.
Faye is now Africa's youngest elected president and announced in a televised speech Wednesday he'll audit Senegal's oil, gas and mining sectors after vowing to renegotiate contracts with oil giants like BP. For more, we go to the capital of Senegal, Dakar, to speak with Ibrahima Kane, a Senegalese lawyer and political analyst, and Aminatou Touré, Senegal's former prime minister. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. Let's begin with former Prime Minister Aminatou Touré. A few weeks ago, we spoke to you when you were detained in the mass protests against President Sall trying to delay the elections and extend his term. Can you talk about what happened in this last few weeks? The new prime minister and president were just in prison. This is quite a moment for Senegal. Aminatou Touré, if you could first respond. Aminatou Touré,
Thank you for having me. We have to backtrack a little bit for further context. President Macky Sall, 2 days ago, delayed his response when he was asked whether he's going to run a third time. This triggered massive demonstration, unfortunately, with life lost. And then finally, last year, he decided to drop the ball. But yet, when we were about to start the electoral campaign, he postponed the election to December. This triggered, again, a massive demonstration. I was arrested during the first march. And at the end, he had to submit himself to the decision of the Constitutional Council. So what this means is that although our democracy has been shaken, the foundation remained quite solid because at the end, democracy prevailed. We went to election and Bassirou Diomaye Faye and Ousmane Sonko got freed. They campaigned for the rest of the campaign because when we started, they were still in jail. And today, as you said, Bassirou Diomaye Faye has been sworn as president and Ousmane Sonko, he appointed Ousmane Sonko as his prime minister. So the lesson to be learned is that, first of all, democracy is not all given. You have to nurture it. You have to be vigilant. We have to alert, and we have to stand by democracy. And that's the lesson that I learned from these months of struggle.
Ibrahima Kane, if you could respond to the remarkable inauguration this week of Bassirou Diomaye Faye, what do you think the significance of this is? And if you could give us some background on who he is.
Well, Bassirou Diomaye Faye is a civil servant. I think he works for the Senegalese administration. With Ousmane Sonko, they decided to create a political party, which is called PASTEF, and to confront the system, as they call it, to make sure that the system works better for the citizen. Because in Senegalese democracy, as we used to see it, the system used to work for those who are in power. The system used to work for those who manage to get power, to hold on in power, and they do everything for themselves, forgetting the population. And this is a young generation of Senegalese who really want to shake the system, as they said, and to really make sure that the system works for the citizen, as we always hope that in a democratic system, the citizen should be the first. The citizen should be at the heart of any public policy. Now, Diomaye and Sonko are now in power. There is a lot of hope from citizens, not just to sort out their problem. And there is a lot of problem in Senegal. Even yesterday in his speech, he said Senegalese are brave, but really they are very, very tired. They are very, very hungry, and there is a need to sort out their problem. And this is where I think the problem will come very soon, because there is the willingness of the two leaders to sort out problem. But is the Senegalese economy, is the Senegalese education system, is the Senegalese social system able to allow him to find job, to allow him to sort out some of these economic problems? I really doubt it. I really doubt it, because the state that they inherited is a state completely down, completely down. And they have only 5 years. And I doubt that in 5 years, you can really change, you can really make a shift in the Senegalese economic political system. But I do hope that they will start taking specific action that will show to the population that at least this generation of leaders are more inclined to help the population than to help themselves. I think that's where the line is.
And finally, former Prime Minister Aminata Touré, they run as Pan-Africanists. The significance of what they're talking about when it comes, as Ibrahimo was talking about, education, where women stand in this government in this final minute that we have.
Well, first of all, I like to say that I'm a little bit optimistic that, you know, my panelist counterpart that just spoke. There's been some economic choices that needs to be reversed, and then we will be able to make a lot of saving in the national budget, and that will improve definitely health and education policy, because President Macky Sall, whom I was his prime minister 10 years ago, invested much more in infrastructure than in building a social capital. So that needs to be reversed. And I can tell you that there are niches where you can save money and redirect those resources toward the people. So that's my first thing. The second thing is, I really share the vision of having Africa as one global space, but starting maybe by West Africa with ECOWAS, the ECOWAS space. We do have within ECOWAS Nigeria, that is the first economy in Africa before South Africa, before Egypt or Algeria. So this is a luck, and they are looking forward to a more integrated zone, economic zone. And that's
Aminata Touré, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue this discussion. Senegal's former prime minister and Ibrahima Kane, Senegalese political analyst, speaking from Dakar. That does it for our show. Saturday night, I'll be speaking in Berkeley at KPFA's 75th anniversary celebration. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Le Tarte, vous écoutez CKUT 90.3 FM à Montréal.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned. It's 6 o'clock, and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio. From drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student, and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jojage in the Ganyekaha language, and Muniyang in Anishinaabe Mohan, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end. I'm your host, Sarah De A, live in studio on Thursday, March 28th, 2024. I'm joined here by Xander Chung, who will be popping up later on in the show. And let's start with some business, some accounting. CKUT's annual funding drive wrapped up on Sunday, and we met our goal of $50,000. Thank you to everyone who contributed some money towards this annual fundraiser. CKUT needs the extra support. We do get money from student